Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.7 in the Matsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and you can find us all over the internet. Just search for Dog Works Radio. You can find us also on iTunes. Again, search for Dog Works Radio, and make sure you hit that subscribe button. And if you like, leave us a review, positive or negative, whichever way, we will get your response. And calling in from, I am sure, sunny California is Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. It's been very nice here. Really nice and sunny, and starting to feel like spring here. I know it's starting to get more and more spring-like up there. I've seen a lot of posts with people talking about doing what they expect will be their last training runs on snow for the winter. And I know we just had the Kobuk 440 finished last week, so it's looking like the mushing season for 2017 is starting to wrap up.
It is winding down. It's absolutely beautiful up here in Alaska. I love this time of year. It's beautiful blue skies. And yes, the snow is melting. But as we said on our last show, it's just sort of a progression from one season to the next. And pretty soon it will be August and early September, and we'll be back out there running the dogs with the ATVs and in the mud and getting right back into it and planning for 2017-2018. So I'm looking forward to that. Alex, I know that you followed the Kobuk 440 pretty close. What do you have to say about that race?
It was a really kind of very exciting and wonderful race. Jason Mackey was out in front for a lot of it. Jesse Holmes, who is a musher whose name is perhaps not as familiar to some of our listeners, won the race. Coming in front of Nick Pettit and Wade Mars, Jason Mackey, Richie Deal, Catherine Keith, Ellen King, and Jeff King, Hugh Neff, Dallas Seavey, finishing 10th, which is sort of seems very far back for a Dallas Seavey finish. It seemed like it was a very, very exciting race. I noticed that a lot of people were posting that it was, the Kobuk is all above the Arctic Circle, and because it is starting to get Alaska's gaining a few minutes of light every day, there was more and more light, and so the temperatures were a little bit higher than what I think a lot of the teams would have liked, and there was just a lot of light way, way into the night for this race.
Right, and you know, a musher's prime time to run his dogs is in the evening, in the night, definitely not in the heat of the day. If we could spend just a little bit of time here on the Kobuk, I did not get a chance to follow up much. I was busy with a visitor that came up from New York that wanted to learn how to run sled dogs on the snow, but I have a couple of questions for you. First off, I know that they don't have a way to track the race like they do Iditarod with video and all that sort of stuff. But I want to mention two folks, and the first person I want to mention is Dallas. And you had mentioned that he came in, I believe you said 10th. That's an interesting departure from where he's usually at. And Dallas doesn't run a lot of the qualifying races and or the races after Iditarod. Was there any talk about the positioning of that race, why he was so far back, so to speak, then, you know, normally we expect to see him right in the front of the pack?
You know, I haven't heard a whole lot about it, but it looks like he finished with only six dogs in harness. So there may have been a problem with some of his dogs. The Kobuk is generally not a race where people finish with a huge number of dogs, but most of the finishers finish with either 9 or 10 dogs.
Right.
And Wade Mars finished with 11. So the fact that Dallas only had six certainly must have meant something.
Right. The other person I want to talk about is Jesse Holmes. And there was a great article in either yesterday or the day before's Alaska Dispatch, and it talked about sort of his coming up in the mushing world. And for folks that may have heard of that name but can't quite put a place on it, he's on a show called Life Below Zero, which is a reality show up here in Alaska, and it talks about sort of the daily life of several families in Alaska, and he is a pretty predominant character on there. I don't know. I guess they're not actors on there if they're on reality, but he is featured on there every week, and it shows about you know, sort of the mushing lifestyle and whatnot. But what's interesting about Jesse Alex is he is slowly becoming one heck of a force to be reckoned with. I think it was last year he won the Yukon Quest 300. He's done very well in some other qualifying races, but he is slowly building a monster, isn't he?
He really is, and I think this is someone that we are going to that we should expect to see really great things from in one or both of the 1,000-mile races sometime in the next couple of years. I know he said that he would like to run Iditarod. He doesn't seem to be in a hurry to get to running Iditarod. He seems to be at least from the articles that I've read, he seems to be very happy with doing these mid-distance races and with you know, getting his dog team really so that they are just a fighting force and getting doing better and better with every race that he runs.
A couple other points on Jesse. I know him on Facebook, and I've met him a few times through my friend Hugh, and he's a heck of a nice guy. But a lot of folks don't know also that he is a very competitive ultra marathon long distance runner. He does a lot of running here in Alaska in the summer, where he runs up and down mountains, and he does all sorts of crazy stuff that a lot of other musher types don't do. I know we've talked several times about Ramey Smith always carrying his running shoes in his sled bag for the last, you know, run into Nome from the coast. But he is a very accomplished runner as he is musher. But what I found interesting, Alex, is when Nick Pettit said he just couldn't keep up with Jesse. And as we know, Nick has a very fast team, whether it's in these qualifying races like Copper Basin or Connect 200 or whatever. He has a very fast team, but he said there was absolutely no way his team could catch up or keep up with Jesse's team. And I think he said they were averaging about 12 or 13 miles an hour for 440 miles of the race. That is almost unheard of in long-distance mushing, isn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, as you said, Nick Pettit is someone who is no stranger to going fast and to really being able to put the pedal to the metal when he needs to. So for Nick to say that he couldn't keep up with someone like Jesse, that is actually saying a tremendous amount.
So I look forward to following him along. I haven't seen a lot of his shows on Life Below Zero. I know it's on the Nat Geo channel. I'm sure you could stream it live. I don't think anybody has regular TV subscriptions anymore. I think the TV is on its way out and streaming is on the way in. How do you watch your content, Alex?
We actually had DirecTV for many years, and we just switched to a cable provider. So we have that for the moment, but I anticipate that probably sometime in the next 3 or 4 years we might get rid of that. And just go to an all streaming
excellent
thing.
All right, so let's jump over in today's topic. And just for a reminder for folks, I don't think that we've had a show, maybe one, if I'm not mistaken, since Iditarod. Is this our first time back, Alex?
I think it might be, yeah.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
I know I traveled a little bit, and we had some crazy things happening in terms of scheduling, but it's good to be back. What do you think?
It is always great to be back. And, you know, even though Iditarod is ending and the season for racing is ending, as you said, these things just continue. And for people who are planning on running next year, they're starting to think about what they're going to need to do to get their team in better shape, or to get their team in good enough shape to run Iditarod or to run the Yukon Quest. So there is lots of stuff that goes on in the off season as well.
You know, I forgot to mention, if we could step back just for a moment for the Kobuk, you had commented on a post, and it was a little video snippet of Kristen Bacon coming into the finish. Can you describe that scene a little bit for us? I know that you really like that.
Oh, this was one of my favorite things that I've seen online in quite a while. And it was this group of three people who described themselves as the Kotzebue Chris and Bacon fan club. And they basically were standing on the side of the trail coming into Kotzebue, and there was nobody around. It was desolate and beautiful and snowy. And then she came in, and as she came in, these three people all just like waved and cheered. And then Kristen started waving and cheering, and it was just a wonderful little 45-second video. We talk a lot about how it means an incredible amount when people who aren't necessarily the front runners or aren't the people who are going to win the race, when they get these kind of acknowledgments and these people cheering them on, whether it's in the middle of the race or more towards the end of the race. So that just really made me happy to see that.
It was a cool little video, and like you said, I love it when people cheer for everyone in the race. You know, so many people, and we always cross-reference other sports, so many people leave when the winner comes in. You know, at football games, if it's a blowout, half the stadium clears out and everybody's, you know, in their cars in the parking lot or whatever because the game is quote-unquote over. But when you're cheering for the little guy or the underdog or whatever you want to call it, that just holds a special place in my heart because I've been there. I've been there myself, not only as a musher, but on teams in school. I've been there cheering for my kids that were maybe not on the best teams of whatever they're playing, softball or football or lacrosse or whatever. I always stay to the end, and I think that's what makes sports so special.
I agree, and you know, especially with mushing, and I've been accused of sort of romanticizing this a little bit, and I'm sure that's true. But I just recognize that anyone who finishes one of these races, if it's a 200-mile race, a 440-mile race, or one of the 1,000-mile races, that is an enormous achievement and always worthy of being celebrated. And so I especially like when the people who are farther back in the pack get this sort of acknowledgement because, it's great for Dallas Seavey and Mitch Seavey to win Iditarod, and it's great for people to have top 10 finishes or top 20 finishes. But when you get closer to the end and people have seen a lot of teams coming in, I think it means a lot to the people who are in the middle or the back of the pack to be acknowledged in that way.
Oh, I agree for sure. So let's jump on over to today's topic. I know when we were talking off air yesterday, you had mentioned two stories that you want to talk about today, but I don't think we were 100% clear on which direction we're going to go. So I'm going to leave the sort of the hosting job in your corner today. What is the story you want to talk about? Then we'll have some commentary.
Sure. So the first thing is Craig Medrid, who is a writer formerly with Alaska Dispatch before it bought the Anchorage Daily News and formed Alaska Dispatch News, has covered Iditarod quite a bit and now writes on craigmedrid.news. He had a commentary about 2 weeks ago about the future of Iditarod and mentioned that, excuse me, two out of the last 3 years, we've had the official restart coming out of Fairbanks. And one of the things that's done is it has resulted in a much faster and more fan-friendly race. So in the 2015 and 2017 races, it was basically a very, very long run down the Yukon River. And a lot of the mushers have objected to that and have said that it was a little bit boring. They liked going over the Alaska Range. They liked the challenge of the gorge and the steps and the Farewell Burn. But one of the things that Craig mentioned is that it is actually a lot cheaper if you're running this Fairbanks route because, among other things, and this is a little bit esoteric, but there's a lot of stuff that has to be shipped to the checkpoints. And when we have this northern route from Fairbanks, stuff can be shipped using Alaska's bypass mail system, which basically is a subsidized way of shipping things to the interior. And when they run the normal routes, there are a bunch of checkpoints like Finger Lake, Roan, and Cripple, and Iditarod that can't be reached that way. So they have to be send everything through usually single engine aircraft, which is much more expensive. So one of the things that he was saying, that Craig was saying, is that if they went to permanently restarting in Fairbanks, that would be a cheaper way to run the race and get material out to a lot of these checkpoints. And also it seems to be a much faster race, at least based on what we saw this year and in 2015.
So I guess my first question to you, and I did not get a chance to read this article, but is cheaper always better? You had mentioned that, sort of the spirit of the race goes on that more original route through some of these other checkpoints, in particular over the Alaska Range and through some of the most difficult areas of the trail. Why do you think he is saying that may be better? Of course, cheaper is definitely an option, but why do you think that would make a better race? Or why does he think, I guess, is a better question?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. Every year we hear about how the Iditarod Trail Committee is having, I don't want to say financial difficulties, but every year the finances and the raising money seems to be a bit of a challenge. So if there were a way to save a significant amount of money on the logistics of the race, I think that would be something that would be worth doing. Another point that he makes is that at a couple of the checkpoints, especially I think Nenana is actually on the road system, so people came out and it wasn't like when we have the restart in Willow and basically 5 or 6 miles into the race you're off the road system. But this way, people could actually come out and interact with the mushers. So that was a little bit more of a friendly thing. And also, I think, and this is probably the most controversial part of it, it seems to be, I'm not sure if this is the right term, but it seems to be a little bit easier trail. The challenges of going over the Alaska Range are very, very substantial, and there's always a lot of people who scratch or who run into problems there. There didn't seem to be nearly as much of that in this year's race and in the 2015 race, and in fact, we noticed that there were many, many fewer people who would scratch in those races where we had the Fairbanks restart. So if we move to that, it could be more of essentially a 1,000-mile sprint race, which in certain ways is more exciting to fans because it's faster and they get to see, records being broken and things like that. But for someone like me, I think I would miss the challenge of going over the Alaska Range. And I know that there's a lot of there's a lot of mythology and lore about that part of the race.
Right. In my opinion, Alex, I think that they should add it into some type of rotation. The last couple of times that it's been here in Fairbanks, it was all weather related. In particular, there wasn't enough snow down in these parts of Alaska. But, as you know, Alex, a lot of people will plan their rookie race in particular about which route that the race is going to be run. And as we know, currently, the system switches every year. The race switches every year, even and odd, from the northern route to the southern route. And I've heard many people talk over the years of I would prefer to run, quote, I would rather run southern route, or I would rather run northern route, or whatever. But if you added in the Fairbanks variable, whether it be every 3 years or whatever, I think that's an interesting type of mix to it. It would sort of be like a triple crown. You know, you run the northern route, then you run the southern route, then you run the Fairbanks route. And then if you do very well or, you know, just finish on all three routes, it's definitely a different race each year, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that even for the people who were, they would say that that it's definitely a race that has its own challenges. So, you know, you're giving up some of the more technical and the more difficult parts of going over the Alaska Range, but then in exchange for that, you get a nice, long, fast run on the Yukon, which, you know, presents its own set of challenges.
I agree for sure. Now, I know you had mentioned as well something about a comparison to NASCAR. What are you talking about there? Is it just the speed of the race or something else?
Yeah, I think it's mostly the speeds of the race and, you know, the idea of getting these checkpoints so that people can go in and out as almost as fast as a NASCAR pit crew, you know, changes the tires and sends the racer back out. So I think that there's a challenge if the Fairbanks route were to be incorporated either permanently or part of a rotation with the other routes, that you would really have the potential to have a race that was much, much faster, both in terms of how fast the dogs are running and in terms of how fast people are able to go in and out of checkpoints and you know, do all their dog care and all of that sort of thing. And it seems that's something that a lot of the top teams are really getting extremely good at, and you know that they have it down to a science where they can just go in and out very, very quickly and get everything done that they need to do.
What also is very interesting there is you know, the Fairbanks route has its own challenges as well. It's obviously not a walk in the park. It may be faster, but it's also, at least on the last two times that they have ran it, it's also a very cold route. As you mentioned, it's primarily on the river, at least until they come off the Yukon. But it's on both of those years, in 15 and here in 17, it's been well below 50 degrees below zero. And that's often not found on the first third of the race on this side. It's an entirely different weather pattern, isn't it?
And I think that also, even though in certain respects it might be easier for fans to follow along and to go up the trail if we went to a Fairbanks route, it's certainly, you know, if you're going somewhere where it's 50 below zero, that is an entirely different circumstance than if you're going somewhere where it's even 20 below zero, which is cold, especially for people who are not used to extreme cold. But there is a big, big difference between 20 below and 50 below.
Right. So it's definitely an interesting conversation, and I don't know if Iditarod is always listening. Craig has definitely an interesting perspective on things, and I love reading his work. He provides a different type of analysis than, you know, a lot of the musher folks that follow the race, and of course a much different analysis than a lot of the media folks. So I think it's an excellent source to follow, not only about the mushy news, but about obscure topics in Alaska in general, don't you think?
Yeah, and I, you know, some people, Craig is a bit of a polarizing force, and some people do not enjoy him, and you know, when they hear that he said something, they are automatically against it because it's coming from him. He's someone who has had a lot of exposure and a lot of experience with the Iditarod and with following mushing in general, and is, in my opinion, is always someone who's very, very interesting to read. I don't always agree with him, but I always enjoy reading him.
I do as well. All right, Alex, we have about 4 minutes left. Do you have another topic that you want to bring up today?
Yeah, you know, I was I was reading a couple of things. There was an article in Jesse Royer's, I believe, hometown newspaper, which said that, and as you know, Jesse Royer finished with all of her dogs in Iditarod, finished, I believe, in fifth place. Great run. But this article said that she basically had not done any serious training runs with her dogs until the middle of January. And then she ran the Yukon Quest and viewed the Yukon Quest as basically a 1,000-mile training run for her dogs to get them in shape to run Iditarod. And she said in this article that she was very ill-prepared for Iditarod when it started, but then went on to just have an amazing, wonderful race. And she was talking at the end of the article about what it would take to really, to really make a challenge to try to win the race. And there was another article where Jeff King was talking about how he doesn't think he's going to be competitive for being able to win the race in the future, because basically it means that he would have to give up an hour or two of rest every time he stops. And he's not quite willing to do that. He said he's a little bit too old to do that, and it makes it a totally different race, that he would rather spend a little bit of extra time and enjoy himself. And so I know we're running out of time, but briefly, Jesse Royer said at the end of the article about her that she's looking to try to be able to move up to the next level, and feels like she needs to be able to have either more sponsors or more financial support, so that because she's competing against, the CVs and Ali Zirkel and people like that, who all they do for 6 or 7 months a year is train their dogs and get their dog team in the best possible condition to win Iditarod. So those are two different perspectives on what it takes to transform yourself from a team that can have a top 10 finish to a team that...
Did we lose you, Alex?
I'm still here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. So so I wanted to get your perspective and see what you thought of, what do you need to be able to move up from, say, finishing fifth or sixth to actually challenging to where you could win the race?
You know, that's an interesting question. First off, I do have to preface that I have not done Iditarod, so I cannot speak on that specifically. But what I do know is Jesse, I believe, lives in Montana. So she has to drive up here every year to compete in whether it be the Quest or the Iditarod. So I think that takes quite a bit out of her already. You know, it's a 5 or 6 day drive, and you have to get your dogs ready, and they're used to being in the truck for several days, both front and back. So I think that is a potential thing that may be holding her back. And like you said, the financial end of it, or the sponsor end of it, if you can afford to do this from October to March every year and not have to worry about, putting food on the table, so to speak, that is what separates, sort of a bad analogy here, but the men from the boys. The folks
right.
that can do this as a full-time job tend to do much better than folks that, that are having to work for a living, having to have jobs while they train, or things of that nature. I think that is two things that is potentially holding her back. But in my opinion, a fifth place finish with all 16 dogs is nothing to sneeze about. She did one heck of a race, and that has to be commended, at least in my book.
Oh, absolutely. And I would hope, and obviously I don't run the world, but I would hope that, sponsors who are looking at someone who is up and coming and someone that they would want to get behind, on a multi-year basis for, thinking 3 or 4 years out in the future, would really be attracted to someone like a Jesse Royer, who I think with a little bit more time and a little bit more money would definitely be someone who would be right up there and able to win the race.
And to end on that note, how about that other Jesse there, Jesse Holmes? So we have two Jessies that are definitely coming up in the mushing world. A lot of folks do not know those two names, but when you hear the name Jesse in the future, you'll know who we're talking about, whether it is male or female. So I look forward to following those guys along, and we will be back in just a week or two for our next show here on Mushing Radio. So on behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, we will see you guys next time.